This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Stephanie Smee left a career in law to work as a literary translator. She's translated many works, including award-winning crime fiction, memoirs, and children's literature. She mostly works in translating French to English, however her other languages include German, Italian, and Swedish. Stephanie has two grown-up children and lives in Sydney with her husband Paul. Her most recent published translation is that of Joseph Pontu's prize-winning work, On the Line, Notes from a Factory, published in Australia by Black Ink. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a complete delight to be with you.
Now, Stephanie, this is our fourth season of the podcast, but you are, in fact, the very first translator to whom we have spoken. So this is really exciting for me. And I recently read On the Line and I was so blown away by it. And I knew immediately that I had to speak to you. So we will get to speaking about that work. But first, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you came to be a literary translator. You left a career in law to make this move. Can you tell us how and why?
Yeah, life throws up all sorts of different things at you, doesn't it? It probably wasn't my intention to be a translator when I was at university, but I just absolutely love what I'm doing now. So it's a fantastic end result, I guess. I did two degrees, as you said, in law, and majored in French as well. And I did work as a solicitor for a number of years. I had never intended, I guess, when I was studying to be a solicitor. I had always wanted a career in DFAT, and when I was offered that position, my now husband had been working in Canberra for a little while already on it with another job, and he said, "Oh, I don't know if I can live there, and what am I going to do?" And it's you know, it was a real question as to how we were going to, you know, organise our lives. So I accepted a job, which I was also, as it happened, offered in the same week in a law firm in Sydney, and carried on with that for a number of years. I think the transition, I guess my other real love was languages. Both my parents are serious polyglots. My mum is Swedish and speaks about five languages. Dad as well. They were both language teachers. He specializes more in the dead languages, ancient Greek and Latin. But I guess that love of languages, it was always in my blood. And then when I had my second child, I just decided, I guess, that I wasn't in love enough with being a commercial solicitor to continue with that work and the sacrifices that it invariably sort of calls on to do. I know many, many of my girlfriends do it very successfully, but for me, I just decided it was a good opportunity to try my hand at something else. So I went and got my translation qualifications, I guess, with NATI, and started work initially as a legal translator, working for a translating firm that was based in Paris. And, you know, we had documents flying all over the world. And it was a fantastic thing for me to do because at the time I could fit it in with the hours around my kids, I guess. So that worked well. And they wanted linguists who had worked in those sort of law firms for whom they were translating documents, because the language register is always tricky if you haven't worked in that environment. Even if you are a native English speaker, it doesn't always come easily. So I did that for a number of years, and then I just had one of those moments and a discussion with my brother, who's a beautiful writer as well. And he said, "You know, why don't you just give it a go, the literary translation side of things? Set yourself a time and see if you can pull it off and you know, take it from there." And I was very fortunate. So yeah, I feel very lucky that I'm now able to do what I do, and I have been doing it for probably over a decade now.
Stephanie, tell me about the first book, the first literary book that you translated. What was that experience like?
Oh, look, that was, I just couldn't believe my luck, I guess. I was working on some French 19th century children's stories by the Comtesse de Ségur, and they were published by the lovely Simon & Schuster here in Australia. And they did such a beautiful job as well with the production. They're gorgeous books. And I think it worked as well for me because my kids, or my daughter in particular, was of an age where she really enjoyed it. I tested out a lot of the dialogue and so on her. I think children are very, you know, unforgiving critics.
Absolutely.
you can tell whether they're with you or not. So that was a really sort of timely project, I think, and I count myself lucky that I was able to do that. Yeah, to start off with that.
I'm really interested in the process, and as a person who has not had the great fortune of being translated yet, I've had my works being translated. When you're obviously not when you're working with 19th century fairy tales, but when you're working with an author, are you in conversation with them, or is the conversation that you're having much more on the page with the words?
Yeah, it's I think probably the latter. Absolutely, to start with. It's a funny thing. I think we Anglophones always assume that everybody else can speak English, which is the first, you know, issue.
Yep, absolutely.
Not everybody can. And there's a funny quote that I always have in mind from, I think from memory, it was the wonderful translator of Cervantes and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Edith Grossman, who quoted somebody as asking her, you know, how she dared to translate this extraordinary work, and did she have enough Spanish? And she was like, well, you've asked me actually the wrong question, which is, do I have enough English? So, you know, you're I guess that's the thing. And I remember Anne Goldstein, who also translated the Elena Ferrante books, making a similar comment that you not only have to be good at, in her case, in Italian, but you have to have sufficient mastery of the English language. So that's a very roundabout answer to your question, which I haven't yet answered. But I think it depends on, I've had experience in both instances, I guess, that conversation can happen where the author is interested and whose English is able to contribute to that. Sometimes even, of course, if their English isn't, then you need to go back to the author to say, what do you think about this solution? You know, is this what you were trying to get at? And you can have that conversation, of course, in French rather, yes. rather than English, and then you're left to work out that solution. So it's a tricky process, but I think often the level of engagement that you may or may not have with an author will depend on, you know, their level of English and interest in that process.
You mentioned there two wonderful translators. Yes. What, in your opinion, are some of the greatest works in translation into English for our listeners that you have read, or ones that are held up as kind of masterful, I suppose?
Oh, that is an interesting question. It's so funny. I read a lot of work in translation from various languages. I've just finished reading an extraordinary work that was shortlisted for the Man Booker last year. In fact, I read two from that selection. It was called The Eighth Life, written originally in German by a woman called Nino Haratchvili. I'm not sure if I'm saying the name correctly there. It was an extraordinary family saga set in Georgia, the country, not the state. And it was just astonishing. Similarly, the other book from that selection was also, interestingly, when I think about it now, German work called Till. It was an amazing piece of translation. I guess what makes a good translation? It's seamless and it's engaging. I often find myself reading books in English thinking, how would I translate that into, you know, how would you work with that? Or how, you know, what it brings to fore a consideration of language that I think is quite different, makes you read differently. And, you know, coming back to Anne Goldstein, with the Elena Ferrante books. She has spoken in the past of drawing the skin over the bones of the Italian, so that the Italian bones sort of show through in the English translation. And I think she achieves that by, you know, allowing certain words to remain in the Italian which can't adequately be translated into English, or making that decision that even if they could be translated, in fact, it's a good thing to remind readers that it was written in Italian first, you know, and that the only reason we are able to read it is because a translator has worked on it. You know, I think that is a real issue, I think, with Anglophones understanding this assumption that these works just appear in English, when in fact, you know, it's the product of an endless amount of work and decision making, you know, along the way.
Absolutely. Do you read? I'm so interested in this process, Stephanie. I'm not sure if you can see my face. I'm like, oh my gosh. Do you often, as part of, I suppose, your professional development as a translator, do you read works in the original language and then in English or in a translation when you're not involved in that translation to see how things are working?
That's a really interesting question. I tend not to read English translations of French books in the main, largely because if they've already been translated into English, I read so much French, I guess, looking for new projects and things that I tend not to read those books that have already been translated. So much of my other reading that I do in English is often work in translation. And I do have, you know, other languages to varying degrees, German and Italian and Scandinavian, Swedish, Scandinavian languages I sort of have a familiarity with as well, the Swedish in particular. And so I do find when I'm reading translations from those languages into English that that I can see, I'm sort of, there's an awareness of what the translator would have had to have done, I guess, sometimes in a lovely way. I'm looking for it, I guess, as a linguist. But I love thinking about that and thinking about those decisions that translators would have made along the way. And I guess I become aware of that because I'm on the hunt for it, I guess, when I'm reading. Mm. And it doesn't always happen. I mean, because it is, if the translator has done their job properly, you're reading it as though you're reading it in English in the original text. And I guess it's just professional curiosity, as you say, to think about, you know, the decisions that they have made. I'm reading a book at the moment that has left a lot of other languages in the English text. And, you know, it's quite a deliberate, conscious decision to do that editorially. And it can work, you know, it can work in different ways for a reader.
I love that phrase, professional curiosity, because I think that it does so expand, as writers, it so expands our notion if we read works in translation of language. And I've been reading and rereading, actually, George Saunders' wonderful new book on writing, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. And it refers to the art of translation quite a lot because he is using seven very famous Russian short stories that have, of course, been translated many times. And it's that juxtaposition of the different translation, which serves to give us incredible insight into the specific kind of choices the translator makes. Mm. At one point, he asks the reader to compare three translations of the same passage. And he comments that in doing so, and I quote, "We might get a sense of the distance that can exist between good translations and the extent to which choices on the level of the phrase create the world of the story." Can you give us some examples of where you've really labored or had to make very difficult decisions on word choices?
Can I just start by saying I'm so excited to hear you speak about George Saunders' book in this way. One of the sort of enduring frustrations I have, and I've listened to a lot of different conversations about that book, is this sort of assumption often by the interviewer that, you know, he's writing about the Russians, he's thinking about the Russians, and yet very rarely do you get any questions about the fact that he is able to work with these texts and teach these texts because they've been translated.
Exactly.
And yet, of course, he deals with that, as you say, in his book, you know, often. It's a funny thing. It's so fascinating. And I would love to ask him, you know, why he has chosen particular translators and translations of the text that he chooses. You know, what is it about those translations that tickle his brain and that he considers the ones that are work best for him? I think I can probably only answer that question generally in that looking at particular issues, I guess. Often sentence length is something which you grapple with as a translator. They are, as an author yourself, you would know they are very specific decisions that you have made as to sentence length, and you need to follow the arc of that sentence through as best you can without making some arbitrary decisions about sentence length and indeed word order. And I think the most useful way I tend to think about it is this sort of musical analogy. If you think of it as a musical performer, say a violinist or a pianist interpreting a score, they make decisions about where rests are going to be, where colour is going to be, what provides that colour in the music. And I think translators are doing that all the time, even down to things like whether or not you're contracting a negative or not, where you put the subject in the sentence, because, you know, that will change the rhythm of that sentence. And I'm struggling as I speak to you to try and give you a particular example. There's not one that immediately leaps to mind, but I think that sort of there is such an oral nature to the task that you are as a translator, as a literary translator, really have at the forefront of your mind the whole time that you're working with those sentences. Yeah.
There's a wonderful exercise, actually, and I had not done it until I was preparing to speak to you, but yes. That for our listeners too, that Saunders puts at the end, it's Appendix C in his book, where he has five different translations of the one sentence, and he asks the reader to first rank them and then to try their own version. And it's an exercise in style, I suppose. And I think, I highly recommend to people who are listening to go out and do that, just to give a sense of exactly what you are talking about there. Like, I was looking and I'm like, well, where's the subject in this sentence and why is it moved? And look, this one's got a comma and none of the other ones have a comma. Such an interesting process.
I know exactly. I went straight to that appendix when I was reading that book, because I was so intrigued by it, because in fact, it was just the perfect explanation in a way for people who aren't translating to sort of understand the nature of that task. The other thing I think that people don't perhaps consider, and this was an interesting point made by the wonderful Jhumpa Lahiri. I don't know if you've listened to any of her interviews about her recent work. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning author who has most recently published a book called Whereabouts, which she wrote in Italian, English being one of her, you know, she writes normally in English, but some years ago she made the decision to write only in Italian. And she has then translated her own work back into English. And she was speaking about that process with another interviewer. And she commented that, you know, translators really are an author's most fierce critic, because they have to think about the text in such a sort of a deep way and see those rhythms and often, you know, pick up things that perhaps an author might not even have been aware that they were doing at the time. But because you are working so intently on that text, it sort of springs out at you as you do it. And so, again, that might be a point for discussion, you know, with the author. Were you intending, you know, this to be the effect of what you were trying, or was it something that just happened unconsciously? Mm-hmm. Should we be drawing that out in the translation? or not. But just that awareness of what the text is doing, it is a very much a forced appreciation of the actual nuts and bolts of what is, you know, making the sentence hum, you know, and making the text hum. That exercise that George Saunders does at the end of the book is so enlightening.
It was marvelous to do it. I want to move on to On the Line, but I can't. I'm so deeply fascinated now. I want to ask, it sounds like it's a quite... it must be very intellectually stimulating, but also draining, the work that you're doing on a day-to-day basis. If you are in the middle of a translation, what does that look like? What's your process? How many pages or words, for instance, can you do at a time before your brain starts to melt?
It is such a, that is such a good question. People say, how long does it take you to translate the book? And you know, there are some days where it just flows beautifully. I'm definitely a morning person. I tend to sort of sit down at my desk fairly promptly and continue through probably to about two or three. I find after that your efficiency just starts to wane, and you can almost feel it because the work feels harder. Mm-hmm. And so your brain is just not finding the solutions, I guess, as quickly as you might. So sometimes the dialogue is magnificent and you just think this is so much fun, you know, translating this. And you really, because ultimately literary translation is the task of finding the voice, you know, it's most obvious, I guess, when you're translating dialogue, but, you know, obviously you're finding the voice of the narrator or the author in other contexts. But sometimes the very structure of the text or the subject matter can be, you know, just require a lot more work, you know, and it takes a lot longer to plow through. And I sometimes I sort of highlight a paragraph and send it through to my friend saying, oh my gosh, look at what I just translated. This is crazy, you know. But it's fun. I mean, that's what tickles your brain. But there are all sorts of different aspects to that task that feels, you know, sometimes it feels better on some day and sometimes you're just, you know, it just feels a bit harder to get to that point. I do think that's where, if you can give the text to somebody else to read at that point, you get a very quick sense of whether that work is obvious on the face of the text. And if it is, you know, then you need to go back and revisit. Mm. And you can sense that yourself, you know, whether that labour is sitting on the surface or not.
That's a lovely way to think of it, the labour sitting on the surface for anyone who's doing any kind of editing or writing.
Yeah.
Stephanie, you mentioned before that you are often on the hunt for new works. And so I want to move now to Joseph Pontu's work and ask you how it came to be in your sphere and how you came to be working on it. And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that work from your perspective too.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the ways I try to track down new projects and so on, work that I'm interested in doing, is just keeping a bit of a finger on the pulse of what's being published and what's coming out in France, and just always looking for interesting projects that, of course, will be interesting to Anglophone readers, because not all of them will be, perhaps. But I came across this particular work On the Line in one of the literary magazines that I subscribed to, and probably at the time it was popping up also on social media and various other things, because it was hugely awarded in France. It won lots of prizes and is such an unusual book that my attention, I guess, was instantly drawn to it. And I contacted my publishers here, who I've worked with previously at Black Ink, and said, this is just the most astonishing book I've ever read. I haven't ever read anything like it before. And, you know, I know that on the face of it, it's unusual, and it's not necessarily going to be the easiest sell, but you need to publish it, and can we make some inquiries about the rights and where they've gone? So that's, I guess, how the process starts. And thankfully, the wonderful Sophie Williams at Black Ink shared my enthusiasm for it. And in terms of process, I translated portions of it for her to pitch to her for the purposes of the pitch. And as I said, she shared my enthusiasm for the project, and the conversation went from there between publishers.
I'm going to be super transparent both with you and with our listeners, although our listeners, some of them will already know this. My next book is set in an abattoir, and it is, among other things, about work and about unionism and production lines and, you know, the state of being human. So I was utterly compelled, not only by the form and the beauty of the book, but also deeply by the content. But I recognise too, and you've mentioned this now, that the content is perhaps very confronting for some. You know, On the Line reads like poetry, but it focuses on Pontu's experience in abattoirs and fish factories and tofu factories. What do you think makes this book so successful?
There is a compulsion to face up to, if you like, the impact on both animals and humans of the choices that we as humans are making as to how we are living, how we are eating, the things we are choosing to eat, the fact that we want to have seafood available in supermarkets, for example, that come from all around the world. What, how does it get there? If we're meat eaters, you know, how are we standing in the butcher shop choosing? And I am a carnivore as well. I have to say, you know, it set me back on my haunches after reading this work for a little while. I was, you know, it brings an awareness to those decisions. I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you're just saying it's about our humanity, really. And I think we can't escape from that when we read this book, and it isn't all bleak. I think there is a profound humanity to the way that the author deals with the subject matter, because, you know, he returns home to his partner, his little dog he needs to walk. You know, there are scenes of how do you fit together the work that you are called upon to do, to pay the rent, to pay the mortgage, and yet come home and function in an environment which is so different to what you've just been forced to endure, you know, in the workplace. How do you retain your humanity in that environment? I think they're really, really important moral questions. It's what literature is there for, generally. You know, to make us think about these questions, which where it's all too easy in our everyday life to just sort of glide over because it's comfortable. The structure, while it looks perhaps different and perhaps confronting to a reader, it is a prose poem, best described as a prose poem, but it reads like a novel. It reads so it's not difficult to read in that respect.
Not at all.
Which I think lends it that appeal to readers, but it also allows some breathing space in the subject matter that it's dealing with, both visually on the page, because there is air on the page. It removes some of the denseness when he's at, you know, when some of the topics really are at their most confronting, I guess. There is an ability to draw breath and to sort of just sit back and process what he's, you know, what he's dealing with in a way that perhaps might not have been so easy if it had been a regular, you know, novel format.
It's extraordinary, and also really highlights, I think, the language choices as well, because you have so much time to sit with each of those lines. It seemed to me, and you spoke before about sometimes the content making things harder for you to translate quickly.
Yes.
And that you are thrown into such an alien world as a translator, and you're being asked to reproduce a work that an author has had in their mind and as an entire whole world for them for a long period of time. So how do you move yourself into that space and ensure kind of fidelity, I suppose, to their original purpose and meaning? Or do you just have to accept from the outset that you can't?
You're approaching it, I guess, just from a different viewpoint. You have the luxury of the fact that the structure is already there for you. So that relieves a big part of your brain from you know, that is the main difference, I guess, from an author, because you are presented with an existing structure. In terms of subject matter, you know, you have, depending on each book. I mean, for this, if you had seen the tabs that were open on my computer, the Australian abattoirs industry and the French abattoir.
I can imagine many of our tabs might look the same and might have looked the same in this past year.
Exactly. And that's part of it with any book that you're translating, because you have to immerse yourself into that language in its vocabulary that we're not using on an everyday basis in English. So, you know, there has to be an authenticity to that that feels correct, just not from a, you know, purely grammatical linguistic, but it has to work in the context as well. And you know, that's where issues like wordplay and humour and all of that stuff, that throws up sort of another whole raft of issues that perhaps you need to let your brain relax a little bit, you know, before that's a good time to walk the dog, to think about,
okay,
how am I going to solve this problem? You know, do a lap of the park and come back and think, okay, well, maybe that's just allowed all the information that you have just focused on so intensely to sort of work out the actual nitty-gritty of the language. But then the next stage of the task is to make it poetic, make the text sing, make it reflect what the author is trying to do. So there are many stages, I guess.
Okay, that's wonderful, because I want to ask you very specifically about page 235. And this is when, Stephanie, I really knew that I must speak to you, because I read this particular section, and I'll read it out here in English. "I must have even managed to rhyme slaughter to mortar, crustacean to flirtation, processing plant to cant, processing plant to can't perhaps." And I thought, oh my gosh, wow. And I'm trying to rack my brains for my year 12 French and thinking, what are those words in French and do they rhyme? And how on earth did she do this and make it work? So
that's, yeah, I mean, you've found, I know exactly the bit that you're talking to, and it's, I guess, not the only instance, but it comes towards the end of the book for your listeners, where I think he's talking at the start of that chapter about, you know, and all the lines he didn't write, that he was standing in the processing plant, trying to find some mental grace as he works in this environment and thinking about what he's going to write to keep himself sane that evening. And you have to, any translator of poetry, and I am not a translator of poetry. There are many skilled translators who work in you know, that throws up a whole different you know, raft of problems. But you have to think flexibly about how you're going to address that challenge, because the author has intended a particular result using words. French is quite generous in that instance often, because many of our words come from French or from a similar base, and so sometimes the rhymes and sometimes, you know, all of that, you know, works more easily. But you then have to take liberties, you know, with how you have chosen to render that particular issue. And I guess those rhymes, as well as humour, that there are a couple of moments where in the book earlier where he has such fun with his wordplay, and that's where you have to be flexible with, yeah.
And that's how you, I mean, by that stage, and you're right, it comes quite close to the end of the book, the voice is so well established. You know, we really do feel like we're so with him. It's quite extraordinary. One of the strange experiences I had when I was reading on the line was this immediate desire to go out and do physical work. And I think that there's moments when Pontu is kind of almost sneering at his previous life of meetings and tea breaks and typing. And it's this tension that he's working through, the kind of the truth or the honesty of physical work and, you know, the factory and the labor, exactly, which nearly breaks him, but also conversely, you know, cures his anxiety because he treats it like therapy. And I'm wondering, what are the kind of responses to this book that you've been seeing and hearing and reading? Because I think it very much spoke to me about the life of someone who does more intellectual work now and the desire to also be a real worker in the world.
That's a really interesting question and response. I guess it's bound up with the fact that our minds are capable of carving out places where you can be preoccupied with, you know, an intellectual pursuit and find your place of grace, I guess, in your head, and yet be called upon also to respond to sort of physical imperatives. And I think it is that very complexity, that human complexity, that the book really brings to the fore. Do you remember that wonderful scene where his mother comments on the way his hands have changed just from the pure effort of working in that environment, and there's an element of pride to that, but just an acknowledgement that this is how it is. You know, it's just a product. This is the impact that this work is going to have on our bodies, but we are capable as humans of keeping part of our brain, our mind, separate from that purely physical work. And I guess that's the response that often people have spoken to me about as well, that just that dichotomy between those two realities that we have to acknowledge in ourselves and in society.
What I didn't realize, and the utter tragedy of this story, and what I realized at the end when I started reading about you, is that Joseph Pontu died this year at the age of 42 from cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about him or about his life? Or
I don't know any details of his illness. The announcement of his death came as a complete shock to me. It was really just profoundly sad, and I think particularly because the translation into English had been due to come out in 2020, and it had been postponed. You know, as I know, a lot of books, that the publication date was shifted because of the pandemic. And there was just this sense as well of sadness that he hadn't seen its emergence into the... He knew it was coming. He'd seen the translation, and the publishers knew absolutely that it was, you know, it was on its way, and in the form that it is now published. So that was a huge relief, but it just a deeply, deeply tragic turn of events, and far too young, and the poignancy, I think, that lends the text upon reading now is really just deeply moving and upsetting. Yeah.
Stephanie, before I let you go, I wanted to ask, as I always ask writers, how their process has changed over time and how they've got better. Are there ways in which you know you've got better at translating over time?
That's a fun question. I think You know, with every project, it sometimes feels like you're back at square one. You know, you're starting again because, as I said earlier, you're just constantly trying to find the voice of that particular text, and that voice is different in each one. I don't know that I would even assert that I have grown better at it. I think the nature of the task is so constantly shifting, with each text being so different, that the challenges that each text throws up, you know, you're starting again with, I guess, each time. I think the way as a translator to feel that you're improving, whether or not you actually are, is just constant reading, but not just in the French, in English as well, and just thinking about language and being immersed in language. And I think, as I said, that sort of deep reading in English is actually almost just as helpful as thinking about things in the French.
How would you suggest, I also always ask writers about a piece of advice for other writers. Now, I'm not sure how many, would-be translators listen to us, but I'm wondering if you can perhaps tell us a little bit about how we can find more works of translation, how we can make sure we have got our finger on the pulse to be reading the kinds of books that you've recommended, because I think it's so important to be bringing more works in translation into our reading as well.
Yeah, look, that's, again, just such an insightful, thoughtful question. Thank you. Look, I feel completely evangelical about the whole cause, and I read, I guess, more literature from elsewhere than I, as a general rule. I think it's the only way we can ever hope to understand what people in other parts of the world are thinking and what is important to them, their literary traditions. And I think particularly now with borders closed and everything, you know, there is no better time to be, you know, on the lookout for translated literature. If someone is looking for where to start, the Man Booker International Prize is a fantastic, you know, look at the short list, look at the long list. You know, there are some extraordinary titles. Keep an eye out for, it's often the smaller independent publishing houses that are really deeply committed to translated literature. Some of them have wonderful subscription possibilities. So there is a wonderful small publishing house in the UK called Pyrene Press, and you can subscribe to them on an annual basis, and they will send you 3 or 4 works in translation a year, usually curated around a theme, and mandate, I guess, is to translate books that wouldn't take that much longer to read than, you know, sitting down and watching a movie or a couple of Netflix series. So they're about 200 pages long, and from all over, they tend to be European based literature, but a wonderful way of getting serious, you know, introduction to some very serious writers from other languages. You have to remember as well that literature that has been translated into English has often jumped through, you know, a lot more hurdles than your average, you know, English text. They have been recognised in the language that they have been published in, first off, often, you know, awarded prizes, critically acclaimed, and then they have to get through the gateway of, you know, translators and publishers, you know, into English. So, you know, I'm not going to say it's always the case, but there is a fairly high chance that you pick up a piece of translated literature in your bookstore and it's going to be pretty good. So it's just helpful, I think, to think about that, you know, there is a reason why they have made it into English, because sadly only 3% or thereabouts of literature on our bookshelves in English is translated literature, and that figure has been like that for years and isn't really shifting, notwithstanding sort of the valiant efforts of smaller publishing houses and so on who who do seem to be very enthusiastic about the cause, which is great.
It is such an education listening to you. We're going to have lots of show notes for this one. Before I let you go, Stephanie Smee, do you have a recommendation for us of one book? I don't know if you could come up with a debut book in translation, but do you have a recommendation for us of one book that our listeners could go out immediately to find, other than On the Line, which I highly recommend?
Yeah, of course, which ticks that box, doesn't it?
It does.
Look, in a bit of shameless self-promotion, one of my earlier translations, No Place to Lay One's Head, by Françoise Frankl, is an extraordinary story and a debut novel, I guess. It's the story of a Polish Jewish woman who opened the first French language bookstore in Berlin. Wow. pre-World War II. And it is then her story of having to abandon that bookstore, and she could no longer then return to Poland. And she is then on the run through Vichy France and trying to escape to safety over the Swiss Alps. And that it was first published when she finally did make it to safety, but then fell out of print and wasn't rediscovered and republished in France until just a couple of years ago. And I was very, very lucky to be able to translate that work. So that's an extraordinary piece of literature, incredibly sort of cinematic, but deeply moving. Every time I proofread it, there were a couple of scenes that just brought me to tears each time. So that would be absolutely one recommendation. I'm also currently reading a book called The Parisian by Isabella Hamad, H-A-M-M-A-D, and it's just marvellous. It's following a protagonist who sets off from Nablus in Palestine to do his medical studies in Montpellier in France, and then up to Paris before having to return to Nablus. And it's a wonderful family saga, but looking at, you know, what's going on in that region in the dying days of the Ottoman Empire as it, you know, is handed over to the British, and incredibly complex, but so beautifully written. The detail in her language is just... it's just astonishing, actually. It's really quite swept me off my feet. I believe that only came out in 2019, and that is Isabella's first book, I believe, as well.
So we will, with pleasure, add both of those to our list. And also there's no such thing as shameless promotion on our show. Stephanie Smee, it has been such an honour. Thank you so much for speaking with me and sharing those insights with us.
I need to thank you as well, Kate, for just A, for having me, but B, for just the thoughtful intelligence of your questions around translation. So it's a real joy to speak to you. Thank you so much.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.